From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mike Seeger, one of the people at the forefront of the folk revival of the 50s and 60s. He co-founded the New Lost City Ramblers and spent years traveling around the rural South recording musicians in their homes. Some of those recordings from the 50s and 60s are collected on a new anthology. We'll talk about the music and about Seeger's musical family. His half-brother is Pete Seeger. His parents were composers and musicologists. Also, we talked to former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timolte. He went from a successful political career to cleaning the latrine in a federal penitentiary after being sentenced for conspiracy to commit fraud. He's written a new book about his 4 months behind bars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Pro-British unionist parties have voted down a plan that would disarm members of the Irish Republican Army during peace talks on the future of Northern Ireland. The talks are now at an impasse. The disarmament issue must be solved before negotiations can go on. The compromise plan had been drafted by the British and Irish governments. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says his government will go on trying to find a way to solve the impasse so that Sinn Féin, the political ally of the IRA, can join the peace talks set to resume in September. Heavy rains are triggering severe flooding in parts of North Carolina. Homes have been evacuated in Charlotte, and thousands of customers are without power. NPR's Adam Hochberg reports.
Dozens of Charlotte residents were forced to evacuate their homes early this morning as parts of the city were swamped with more than 6 inches of rain. No injuries have been reported, but rescuers had to use boats to help people escape their flooded homes and apartments. Emergency shelters have been set up at Charlotte schools, while police have closed off a number of bridges and major highways because of high water. Power companies say more than 5,000 customers are without electricity. In the Greensboro, North Carolina area, authorities are reporting wind and lightning damage. Dozens of trees are down, and 4 houses were struck by lightning. The severe storms continue to move through central North Carolina today, and flash flood warnings are in place for several counties. I'm Adam Hochberg in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Days after settling a costly 3-month strike in Pontiac, Michigan, General Motors has been hit by another work stoppage, this time at a transmission plant in suburban Detroit. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
The latest strike against GM started at midnight when some 2,800 workers at a plant in Warren, Michigan set up pickets. This plant supplies a large number of other GM vehicles with transmissions, and if the strike lasts more than a couple of days, it'll lead to production disrupting parts shortages at plants across the country. GM has been hit by a seemingly endless series of strikes at individual plants in recent years. The Warren strike is the 6th against the automaker this year. The issues are similar from place to place. Workers are concerned about the contracting of work to outside suppliers, and they complain that they're being forced to put in too many hours. Separately, GM averted another strike last night when it reached a tentative agreement at a parts plant in Indiana. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Republican lawmakers say House Speaker Newt Gingrich has reasserted his authority in the chamber. The lawmakers say Gingrich told them there is a single line of authority in the House and that he's it. House Republicans are to attend another meeting this evening to hear a full accounting of a failed coup to oust Gingrich last week. Many rank-and-file lawmakers want to know if other GOP leaders participated in planning that coup. On Wall Street, the Dow's up 36 points at 8,097. Trading's heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it's another day of record setting on Wall Street. The Dow is in record territory. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are taking encouragement from several better-than-expected earnings reports. Allied Signal, DuPont, and Bain Networks were among the companies surpassing profit expectations. The market is also benefiting from the outlook for stable interest rates. This morning, Fed Chairman Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee he's in no hurry to raise rates because the economy shows evidence it could be entering a new era of faster growth with low inflation. Among the active issues, Boeing and McDonnell Douglas have rallied after the European Commission agreed in principle to approve their $15 billion merger. I'm Doug Krisner.
All but one member of the Senate committee looking into alleged campaign fundraising abuse have voted to grant immunity to four Buddhist nuns in exchange for their testimony. The nuns made donations to the Democratic Party last year at an event that Vice President Al Gore attended. The nuns were reimbursed by the temple. The Justice Department had asked the committee not to grant the immunity because that might harm its ongoing criminal investigation into fundraising abuse. But Senator Sam Brownback pointed out the agency has had the case for months and has had lots of time to decide whether to prosecute the women. Time Warner and the News Corporation, owned by Rupert Murdoch, have ended a fight with an agreement that will give Murdoch's all-news cable channel access to Time Warner's cable system. Time Warner says its New York cable system will now carry Murdoch's 24-hour news channel. The agreement is part of a larger deal that gives Murdoch access to well over half of the Time Warner systems across the country. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Seeger is one of the musicians who helped spark the folk revival of the 50s and 60s. In 1958, he co-founded the New Lost City Ramblers, a group of middle-class urban musicians like himself who revived the old-time string band music of the rural South. In the 50s and 60s, Seeger also made many field recordings for Folkways Records. Some of his field recordings from the 50s and 60s that were never released are compiled on a new CD called Close to Home. We're going to hear some of those recordings and the stories behind them. Mike Seeger is part of one of America's most famous folk music families. His half-brother is Pete Seeger. His sister is folk singer Peggy Seeger. Mike's mother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, was a composer who also collected children's songs. Mike's father was musicologist Charles Seeger. The first track on Mike's new anthology features guitarist and singer Elizabeth Cotton. She's famous now in folk music circles, but she wasn't when this recording was made in 1952. I asked Mike Seeger how his family met her.
I met her at our home in Chevy Chase, Maryland. My mother had met her at a department store in Washington and asked her to help around the house. Elizabeth Cotton worked most of her life in people's homes, helping wash and cook and take care of children. And that was the way I met her, in our home, one day a week for a long time.
Did you know that she could play and sing so well?
Not for 4 or 5 years of her being in our household. And it was only after I started playing that my sister Peggy discovered that Elizabeth Cotton could play music.
How did Peggy discover that?
Well, now, I don't know it from Peggy's side, but Libba Cotton would say, always tell the story on her programs, that Peggy discovered her playing the family guitar and that Ms. Cotton was really embarrassed because she wasn't supposed to be doing that.
Tell us the story behind the specific recording we're going to hear that was made in 1952, I believe in your house.
Yes. Well, at this point, we had known that Libba Cotton could play guitar for about 6 or 8 months, and Pete came to visit us, my brother Pete. And so we asked Libba Cotton after a whole day's work, and for her, a day's work was, I think, at least 10 or 11 hours. We asked her if she would play some for us and Pete, and my father had just brought a tape recorder home from work. She didn't have a guitar at the time, and she'd been playing the family gut string guitar. They didn't have nylon yet. And she played a guitar that had steel strings on it that a friend of Pete's had brought down. And so her touch was a little bit unsure at times, but she was wonderfully solid even then. It's amazing to think of a woman who was 55, hadn't played guitar much for about 25 or 30 years, discovering again that she could play guitar and playing for us.
So let's hear her recording of In the Sweet By and By, recorded in your home in 1952. Thank you. Elizabeth Cotton, as recorded by Mike Seeger and his family in 1952. And that recording has been reissued on Mike Seeger's new album, Close to Home, old-time music from Mike Seeger's collection recorded between 1952 and 1967. Mike Seeger, the field recordings that have been collected on your CD, Close to Home, span 1952 to 1967. Tell us how you defined your mission in making these recordings back then.
I was reared by a family, by two avant-garde musicians, that is, who composed and thought about modernist music, who discovered folk music in the 30s. And they'd always had a feeling of mission, whether it was modernist music or a modernist approach to folk music. And when I'm talking of folk music, I mean traditional rural music of the working class or agricultural people, folks from, who were the majority, I guess, of people in the United States until industrialization started. Anyway, what I want to say is that they gave me this feeling of mission, too. It just wiped off, it rubbed off on me. And I hear all this music around, or I had heard all this music around me, and I wanted to, for other people to be able to hear it and to be able to play it and appreciate these wonderful musicians.
When you started traveling around, entering people's homes and recording them, were you always welcome? Did you always already have a relationship with the people whose homes you entered?
I was very music-centered. I was always that way. And so I usually entered people's homes on the basis of, I like your music and I like you. And usually that communicated. Only once or twice did it not, and it's only when perhaps there were other issues that were preventing it on the other person's side.
Were you performing yourself when you were when you started recording other people?
Yes, I started trying to play. My mother got me started really when I was in my late teens, and yes, I could always play a little bit, and I think that interested people. I wasn't dressed very well. I didn't have much money, and I just liked what I was doing, and there was no money involved at all, and there still isn't much.
Let's hear another recording that's on your new anthology. This is a 1962 recording featuring Ernest and Hattie Stoneman, and the song is Gather in the Golden Grain. Tell us something about these performers, how you met them, how this recording came to be.
I'd heard recordings of Ernest and Hattie Stoneman first on a recording, an anthology called The Anthology of American Folk Music, edited by Harry Smith, which incidentally is going to be re-released by Smithsonian Folkways in August. And I went to a fiddler's contest in rural Maryland, somewhere over near Glen Burnie, which is near Baltimore. And they had a lot of rural people, mostly from the South, but some from around in the rural area of rural Maryland, too. Ernest Stoneman was there. He was there with his own band, and I was so struck by his playing of the auto harp and just by seeing him and hearing him and realizing that this man who had recorded back in the 20s, in the 1960s, was still there, that I went and asked him if I could visit him at his home. And which I did. I asked he and his wife, Hattie, if they would record a couple of the gospel songs. And the old pump organ that she'd given him when they married, it was kind of leaky, I think, and they could only make it through about a minute of the song. Hattie was always reluctant to play. So it only lasts a minute, but it's a wonderful little piece of music.
That's a wonderful minute. Why don't we hear it?
Be vain, for he will increase yield.
That's recorded in 1962, recorded by my guest Mike Seeger, and featured on his new anthology Close to Home, old-time music from Mike Seeger's collection, 1952 to 1967. You point out in the liner notes that they're singing one octave apart from each other. Is that a common way of singing together in rural country music?
Well, it's an informal way of singing together, and that's the way they sing in church. And it, in my mind, it's a way of singing that predates the ideas of harmony, which are pretty popular these days. It's considered kind of corny now to sing either in unison or in octaves. So it's a family way, really. It's a family style.
I want to move on to another tune collected on this new CD, and it features Pearly Grandma Davis, about whom I know nothing. The song is called It's These Hard Times. Tell us something about her and this recording.
I wish I could tell you more about Grandma Davis. Back in the 50s and 60s, before the mid-60s, fiddlers' conventions in the South had a lot of old-time country people who just show up and play a few songs. Quite often there were songs that would be out of their home repertoire, you know. And I was very struck by her singing and playing when I heard her at the Union Grove Fiddlers Convention about 1960 or 61. So on another trip south with John Cohen, we were doing a swing through the South, especially through North Carolina, Tennessee. We stopped off and saw her and her family, and she lived in a nice frame house in Roaring River, North Carolina, without electricity. She didn't trust electricity. So we went across the street to one of her kids' houses and had a wonderful evening of music there. And this is just one song of several that she sang during the course of that evening of us singing and playing for one another, really, because John and I played some, too, for them. We just entertained one another, and she entertained us with this.
This is Pearly Grandma Davis, recorded in 1961.
A song you should hear concerning those boys who lives about here. It is the truth, boys, you can't disown. You pull a girl about like a dog while a bone, and it's these hard times. Girls about here, the wood where the hoops won't for the comfort, it is just for the looks. A belief to my soul, if the boys won't talk, they'd worm so large they'd take a sidewalk, and it's these hard times. Girls about here, they'll grin like a cat, they'll tittle in their tattle, and they don't know what it said. It is the truth, boys, you can't disown. You pull a girl about like a dog well a bone, and it's these hard times. Tell a good girl, wherever she be, no flashy things on you never will see. No laces, no braces, no such other thing, but a long-tailed bonnet pinned under her chin, and it's these hard times. Yonder's a doctor I'd almost got. Believe to my soul, he's the worst in the lot. He says he'll cure you for half you possess, and then he'll kill you and take all the rest. These hard times.
Music recorded by Mike Seeger, included on his new CD, Close to Home. We'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with folk musician Mike Seeger, some of his field recordings from the 50s and 60s are collected on his new CD, Close to Home. Now, I think one of the people who you recorded more than any other is Doc Boggs. What do you think his importance is musically?
Well, he just had a gut feeling to his music through his voice, and a certain way of picking the banjo on some of the songs that really just get to you. I'm without words, Terry, because I think it's probably a good idea just to listen to the music.
Okay. And why don't we do that? Tell us about the recording that you made that's featured on the CD of Doc Box.
Well, I went way out of my way to try to find this man, because when I was 10 or 11 years old, I heard recordings of his for the first time, and I always wanted to find this man or find out what he was about. And by asking various different people, I eventually, on a trip from California to home in New Jersey at the time, I found Doc Boggs, met him, recorded three, four new LPs at the time, and got him to travel around a little bit to some of the folk concerts and festivals. So I got to know him pretty well, and I recorded him at his home. And this was for an LP. Most of the recordings that I made here were not for any idea that they'd ever be released commercially. This one, however, was.
This is Doc Boggs, recorded in 1964. Doc Boggs, recorded in 1964 by my guest, Mike Seeger. And we should mention that Doc Boggs is also featured on that anthology of American folk music compiled by Harry Smith, which is getting reissued now, a very influential anthology. And there's a chapter on Doc Boggs in Grill Marcus's new book about Bob Dylan, The Basement Tapes. Mike Seeger, I'd like to hear more about you and your life in music. It seems to me you're really part of the first generation of country folk musicians who weren't born into that tradition. You're from the urban north, a member of the educated middle class. And the music that most inspired you was music largely played by rural southerners who didn't have the kind of formal education that you are from. Did you see yourself that way as part of the first generation of people who were playing music that was traditional music, but they weren't part of that tradition?
I don't know how much I ever thought about that. I rebelled against formal education, which my parents had so much of. I learned the music by ear, and I just loved it so much. Ever since I was 4 or 5 years old, I was singing these old songs, and then when I started playing, I was playing in the style that appealed to me most. Maybe it's because we didn't have a radio. Maybe it's because I only listened to this kind of music because that's the only kind of recorded music we had at home. But something in me resonated, or these songs, these sounds resonated to me, and it's been the center of my life ever since.
Now, you mentioned that you grew up without a radio. I find it very interesting that your parents, who were music scholars and composers and teachers, and were probably among the first families to have a tape recorder in their own home, didn't own a radio. Why not?
Well, actually, the tape recorder was only there for one day.
Oh.
My mother did have a transcription turntable through which I could hear all of these things. That was in the day when you had to sharpen cactus needles to listen to records. and we didn't have any commercial records. We only had field recordings to listen to. They were determined that I wouldn't be reared on commercial mass media, which was just getting started in the 20s and 30s. And, well, they succeeded.
Was their goal in life to make sure you never heard Louis Armstrong or Bing Crosby or Duke Ellington?
Maybe Bing Crosby out of those. They were not... I think they weren't impressed by a lot of jazz, even. But they wanted me to... Well, they felt that, I think, that this music had been the oral tradition for people for centuries and centuries. And they just wanted to continue, although obviously within a modern life. I don't think they ever expected that I would be doing this for a living. They just wanted me to have it in my life.
Mike Seeger's new CD is called Close to Home, featuring his field recordings from 1952 to 67. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and here's Sarah Carter Bays and Mother Mabel Carter from the new CD.
I'm leaving you this lonesome song.
I'm leaving you
this lonesome song.
I'm leaving you
this lonesome song.
'Cause I'll be gone, long gone, someday for long.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Mike Seeger. And we talked to former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timelty about cleaning the latrines in a federal penitentiary after he was sentenced to 4 months for conspiracy to commit fraud. He has a new book called Prison Journal. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike Seeger. His new anthology, Close to Home, features field recordings he made in the South in the 1950s and 60s. Seeger is from a musical family. His half-brother is Pete Seeger. His sister is folk singer Peggy Seeger. His father, Charles Seeger, was a musicologist. His mother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, was a modernist composer. When we left off, Mike was telling us that his parents loved traditional music, but the art songs his mother composed were hardly folk music. I thought I'd play a song that your mother wrote that was recently recorded by Dawn Upshaw. This is a song called White Moon, and it's a setting for a poem by Carl Sandburg. And I just want to give a sense of what your mother was up to.
She had been up to this 2 or 3 years before I was born and basically gave up that kind of music.
Oh, no kidding.
When I was born or shortly before. And they went completely over into folk music so that we didn't know anything about that kind of music. Well, I had one 78 RPM record of her string quartet, which I enjoyed listening to when I was a kid.
Well, let's hear this recording of White Moon, then we'll find out why your mother abandoned that kind of song. This is Dawn Upshaw.
The shafts across her bed are flimmering. Out on the land, white moon shines, shines and glimmers against gnarled shadows.
Well, I think that gives us a sense of the song, a song written by your mother, Ruth Crawford Seeger, a setting for a poem by Carl Sandburg, sung by Dawn Upshaw. So tell us why she gave up that kind of music around the time you were born.
This was in the early days of the Depression, when there was a lot of soul-searching by modernist musicians, by a lot of people, looking for what is American, looking for something that would have some social activist, political activist use. And they shifted from one avant-garde to another, I guess, from the avant-garde of composed music-making to the avant-garde of thinking about music that would have social use and also the continuity of musical traditions and trying to respect American culture as it was.
Did your mother feel the music was too intellectualized, too removed from popular taste?
From everyday reality and from the experience of most people, yes. It has a different use. And I think that's the nicest recording that I've heard.
Oh, it's a lovely recording. It's Dawn Upshaw. What else can you say? It's really a lovely recording.
But it's just different. My mother was absolutely intrigued with the complexities of rural music making, mm-hmm. singing especially.
Mm-hmm. No, your half-brother is Pete Seeger. Did you actually live with him when you were growing up? I know he is, I believe, your father's son with your father's first wife, who was not your mother. So he has the same father, but a different mother. How old was he when you were born?
He would have been 14, and we didn't live together, no, but we had visits, mm-hmm. and they were always high points.
Was he somebody who inspired you or someone who made you think that you had to stay away from what he was doing because just to preserve your own identity?
There are parts of what he did which influenced me a lot early on, and others have stayed with me. The overall ideas of... how would I say it? Attitude towards music has a lot... I feel like I've gotten a lot from Pete. Early on, yes, I learned a little bit from Pete, more than a little bit.
When you say you learned a lot about attitude toward music, what attitude are you talking about?
I think it has to do with inclusiveness,
mm-hmm.
Of attitude towards other musicians, Of course, some of this came from my parents, too, but a lot of it came from Pete.
Now, your new CD is a field recordings that you made between 1957 and 1962. In 1958, you co-formed the New Lost City Ramblers, which was a group of people like you who weren't a part of that Southern world tradition but loved the music and wanted to play it and sing it and keep it alive. Tell us a little bit about founding the group.
Well, it was an accident. In those days, in the 50s, if you played this kind of music, you knew that there were only about 5 or 10 people in the cities playing it, and you knew them. And we were also aware of that this music was dying out gradually in the South, being basically dominated over by contemporary commercial forms. So we did know one another. We met Tom Paley and John Cohen and myself. We met we met separately at various times in the 50s, but the three of us played together on a radio program, just kind of guesting, and it seemed to work well enough so that John said, well, how about we record for Folkways, and how about we do a concert in New York? And I said, okay. And from then on, we've been a group with one change of personnel in 1962.
Well, let me play a track from the New Lost City Ramblers CD that you recently put out, first recording together in 23 years. And why don't we hear a song that a lot of people will know as an old kid song, Skip to My Lou. Why did you adults decide to do this?
Because we like the song. Some people think it's pretty far out to have a song that says Little Red Wagon Painted Blue. And it's also just a playful song. And it was also, in its original form, meant for accordion game in the days when they thought that dancing in the usual way was sinful. And so this was not meant to be done with sinful musical string instruments. It was supposed to be sung by people in their teens to keep them out of trouble.
Oh, I never knew that.
Well, that's what the folklore is anyway.
Right. Okay. Well, this is Skip to My Lou, Mike Seeger, lead vocals, harmonica, and ukulele.
Skip the Maloo, my darling. Yonder she comes, how do you do? Yonder she comes, skip the Maloo. Yonder she comes, and how do you do? Skip the Maloo, my darling. Redbird, prettier too. Pretty as a redbird, skip to Maloo. Pretty as a redbird, prettier too. Skip to Maloo, my darling.
Skip to My Lou, that's the New Lost City Ramblers with my guest Mike Seeger, lead vocals. It seems to me one of the things you really have in common with so many of the country musicians, old-time musicians, whose work you documented over the years, is that you come from a family of music people. I mean, part of the old-time tradition, I think, is a family tradition. There were so many bands that were made up of families, husbands and wives who sang together. The children maybe sang together, too. And, I mean, gee, in your family, you had, you know, your parents, and then Pete Seeger's part of the family, and your sister Peggy, who's also a singer. I mean, what a great musical family.
We enjoy playing music together, and it's one of the things that we do when we do get together on holidays or just on visits. I feel real fortunate. Yes, I feel real fortunate.
Well, Mike Seeger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been fun, Terry. Thanks for asking.
Mike Seeger has a new anthology of field recordings he made in the rural South between 1957 and 62. It's called Close to Home. Coming up, a former Massachusetts state senator on his 4 months in a federal penitentiary. This is Fresh Air. Joseph Timmelty went from the Massachusetts State House to the prison house. After serving 5 terms as a state senator, running for mayor of Boston 3 times, and serving on a housing commission in the administration of President Jimmy Carter, Timmelty was sentenced to 4 months for conspiracy to commit fraud in a condominium development project in which he was a partner. Timmelty has maintained he was guilty of stupidity, signing a contract he didn't fully understand, but not guilty of conspiracy. He served his time at a federal penitentiary in Pennsylvania. He secretly kept a prison journal, which was against the prison rules. With the help of Boston Globe feature writer Jack Thomas, he's adapted it into the new book, Prison Journal. The book also includes his recommendations for prison reform. Timmelty entered prison in early October 1993. I asked him if the prison was mostly for white-collar criminals.
No, not necessarily. The prison I was sent to was for first-time nonviolent offenders. The majority of people who were incarcerated there were first-time drug dealers from Spanish Harlem and from New York, the ghetto of New York and Washington. And white-collar criminals were a vast minority of individuals that were there.
One of your suggestions for prison reform is to create meaningful work for people who are incarcerated. You had to work while you were in prison, and you, in fact, started working in the library. That sounds like it had the potential to be as meaningful as you can get in a prison. Was it meaningful work?
No, what a surprise I got. I asked to go to the library because I thought it would give me an opportunity to further my writing, knowing I was going to do it, or at least attempt to do the journal that we now talk about. So that when I finally achieved my request and got there, I was surprised to find out I was nothing more than a guard sitting behind a desk, making sure that people kept the noise down. There were no books for them to check out. There were no books, really, for them to read. The only real reading material that you had for 300 men was 1 or 2 USA Todays that came in and, maybe a late Time magazine. And people were asked to check them out so that you'd know exactly who was taking them. And then when you'd look at the book when you came in the morning to see who checked out the reading material for the last night, you'd see names like Bill Clinton, Janet Reno, Frank Sinatra. Nobody would give their right name. It was that the library itself was a joke.
You asked to be transferred from the library. In fact, you asked to be transferred to latrine duty, and I don't know, my first reaction is, who in the world would ask to be transferred from the library to cleaning the latrine? Why did you ask for that transfer?
There was an individual, again from Philadelphia, who was in charge of the discussion group, which was a group of Catholics and Protestants and Jews that got together every Sunday night. He was a very intelligent guy from the Protestant population, and he had that duty before I did.
Which duty, the latrine or the library?
The latrine.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that. And you could see because he hung around the library when he wasn't in the latrine, you could see that I was very unhappy with the library duty. And he said to me that he was getting ready to go to a halfway house. In other words, he was getting ready to go out of the prison population and go back to Philadelphia to a halfway house. He said that job was coming up. I ought to think about it. And I said the last thing I'd want is to be cleaning up a latrine. And he said, well, you ought to meet me some morning and see how I do it. And I did. And he said, it takes you basically about an hour to clean this whole facility up. He says, you have the rest of the day to yourself. You're your own boss. And as long as the place is clean, nobody's going to bother you because nobody thinks that anybody can keep this clean. He says, I've been able to do it. He says, this is something you ought to think about because even though you're sitting all day long in the library, this gives you a whole host of more freedom. Plus, it's not a hard thing to clean. All you need is a pair of gloves and some Lysol. Well, after seeing what he was referring to, I volunteered for that duty. And I was so glad to get out of the library. It was one of the best things that I had done. It gave me a much more time to move around the facility. The place was easy to clean. It gave me a chance to kibitz with all kinds of prisoners that were coming by, because the latrine was in the hallway of the administration building. Gave me all kinds of access to different individuals. So he was right. It was a great move for me.
Let me ask you, while you were cleaning the latrine, if there was another prisoner inside who had a grudge against you, would he dirty the latrine to get back at you?
Sure. Your level of intelligence within the populations there was not Harvard and the Charles. Sure, there were some people who would try to do that. But if I have my gloves and armed with my gloves and my Lysol and my brush, I mean, how much damage can they do to a commode or a urinal or the floor? And if they did that, I'd have to reciprocate in some like manner, and they'd never do it again.
Well, what could you do to reciprocate?
Well, it would do a whole host of things. Make sure that the next time they came needing the latrine, that it would be closed for repair. making sure that they were, the next time they came looking for the latrine, that there was no toilet paper. There were a whole host of things that you could do to meet the demand.
Now, you were in a prison for nonviolent first offenders. Was there much violence inside?
They frowned on violence.
Who's they? The prisoners? The authorities?
No, the authorities. And any time they witnessed any violence whatsoever, they would react immediately by pulling that person out of the population. But violence was always like a coat of paint. It was like right under the surface all the time. And I was warned when I first got there. I was warned of a lot of things. But one of the key things was suggested to me, Joe, stay out of the TV room. If there's a fight, it's going to happen in two areas, either over the TV or over chow. For example, in the TV room, there was always a great debate as to what station people were going to watch. There was a whole, the first time I had ever been introduced to it, by the way, there were a whole combine of Trekkers, people who were absolutely addicted to Star Trek. And anybody that would try to change the station at a time when Star Trek was on, there was going to be a fight.
My guest is former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timelty. His new book is called Prison Journal. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with former Massachusetts State Senator Joseph Timelty, his new book Prison Journal is about the 4 months he spent at a federal penitentiary in Pennsylvania, serving time for fraud conspiracy related to a real estate development in which he was a partner. Give us a sense of what your daily schedule was like inside.
I'd get up earlier than most because, one, I found that I could do my wash at that time, and the washing machines were empty. So I'd get up around 4:30, realizing everybody else would get up around 6. And I also did that because I could get into the bathroom and clean a sink and clean an area. That's the way I was brought up. And then I'd have a head start on the day, and then by the time 6 o'clock came around, when everybody else got up and the chow line opened, I'd be one of the first people over there. And I found breakfast was a pretty good setting. I would be at the breakfast hall for maybe an hour, having a cup of coffee, just sitting talking to the other inmates. Then I would open up the latrine, clean it, be out of there without a rush by 9:30. Then I'd go find some place to write, and that's the end product that we have here. After that, about 11 or 12 o'clock, I'd find a way to get to lunch, and then after lunch, I'd work out for an hour, I'd work out for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then clean up again and go back to my writing. So it was basically, like everybody else, it was make work. Find something to do, occupy your time. The main thing I wanted to do every day was to write my journal and also to get a workout so that I'd sleep at night.
Now let me ask you, it sounds like it was an experience with a lot of potential for being, you know, meaningless and empty. On the other hand, it doesn't sound like you were suffering terribly within that daily regimen. You know, breakfast, an hour of cleaning, a workout, writing. I've heard a lot worse. Some people criticize these minimum security prisons for nonviolent offenders for being like country clubs. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, it's not a fair criticism. I mean, the big thing with me was I was a prisoner, and I was restricted from being with my family. That, to me, was a total loss. Now, I don't care whether you have me in isolation for 24 hours a day, or in the scenario that I just outlined for you. I still don't have an opportunity of being with my family. At night, I stay there. I'm frozen into space for a period of time. I'm restricted from the thing that was most important to me, which was my freedom and my family.
If you could have sentenced yourself to something, I know you think you shouldn't have been found guilty in the first place, but let's say you're found guilty and you had to give yourself some kind of sentence. How would the sentence you gave yourself compare to what you were actually sentenced to?
I'd find some way to have me live at home on some kind of a bracelet and provide public service to community groups, nonprofit groups in the area of expertise that would have them get government grants and be able to get to do government applications for the quickly vanishing federal dollar for community improvement. It'd be one of the ways that that I could have helped them. And then if I did that, I'd have to pay for the bracelet myself. I wouldn't have a disruption of the home life, which in a lot of cases is devastating to families.
But I think the public wants to see a white-collar criminal suffer for his crime, to be punished in a way that hurts.
Well, then I think that we look at the outcome. First of all, for a white-collar criminal like myself, the day I was indicted, my reputation was through for the rest of my life. It doesn't make any difference if they sent me away for 5 days or 5 years. It doesn't improve or deprove my reputation. It's already gone. The day I'm found guilty by a jury, I'm devastated as a white-collar criminal. Now, if I'm a banker, that means I'm never able to bank again. If I'm a lawyer, that means I'm never able to be a lawyer again. If I'm a doctor, that means I'm never able to doctor again. So, I mean, how much punishment do you want to have effect? Why punish the taxpayers along with the individual?
After your 4 months inside this minimum security prison, you were sent to a halfway house. Now, ironically, this was a halfway house that you helped establish in spite of protests by residents of the community who were afraid that the halfway house would bring a kind of criminal, dangerous element into the neighborhood. Tell me first why you supported this controversial halfway house.
Well, I've always believed in alternative sentencing, and if you're going to have those kinds of alternatives, then they should be located within the community. I mean, you can't isolate them. The place that, that we're referring to was an old Mariner Hotel that had seen it better days and was in disrepair. It seemed to me to be a perfect setting for a halfway house. It was across the street from the YMCA. It was downtown Boston. It was availability of jobs. It had all of the kinds of assets that you'd want for a population that was trying to get back into society.
You had mentioned that you feel as soon as you were convicted that your reputation was ruined and much of your professional life was over. What kind of work are you doing now?
I work as a lobbyist. I represent clients at the State House in Massachusetts.
So your professional life was not totally ruined by the conviction?
Well, let's let your listeners decide that. I was an elected official for somewhere around 18 years. I put my name in the ballot, and most time I was unopposed. And now my life has changed so that I now represent racetracks at the Massachusetts legislature. Now, I think that's a far cry from being an elected official.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry.
Joseph Timilty's new book is called Prison Journal. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.